To my sovereign liege, King Henry VIII. Whereas it pleased your highness, upon very just consideration, to encourage me, by the authority of your most gracious commission, in the 35th year of your prosperous reign, to peruse and diligently to search all the libraries of monasteries and colleges of this your noble realm, to the intent that the monuments of ancient writers might be brought out of deadly darkness to lively light.
The antiquarian scholar John Leyland here addresses his liege lord, King Henry VIII, in 1546. For 13 years, he reminds his monarch, he has travelled tirelessly for the king, rooting out ancient texts from monastic libraries the length and breadth of the land in his first phase of travelling, and mentally mapping every inch of Henry's Empire of England and of Wales in the second. Now, as a New Year's gift, he promises to write up everything seen and learned on his laborious journey, including a four-volume history of British writers and an exhaustive description of Henry's kingdom, a book for every shire. But by 1547, before any of this could be realised, John Leyland was insane. Henry was dead, and the monasteries were gone. For me, Leyland's terminal case of writer's block is the most poignant in all English history. Never has a man travelled so far, taking so many notes, to produce so little. To travel with John Leyland is to witness unparalleled changes in English culture and English landscape, as medieval Catholicism yields to the power of a centralised Tudor state. But what does it mean to help destroy the thing you love, to pose as an agent of revolutionary history, while yet dreading or doubting its revolutionary effects? Leyland had honed his New Age literary skills, the perfect training for a Henrician new man, on the banks of the Thames at St. Paul's School.
John Collett, who was the Dean of St. Paul's at the time, conceived a refoundation not just as a practical matter, but with a really strong idea of a kind of education that he wanted to put forward.
The early modern scholar, Brian Cummings, speaking at Leyland's alma mater.
And it was said that only four men could speak or read and write Greek in England in 1500, which is just before the school was founded. But certainly Collett sets up, even in the statutes, that he wants the teaching of Greek as well as Latin literature.
So the idea of a revolutionary break with the past is there in Leyland's education?
It's there in Leyland's education. The whole aim of the school turned from the production of potential priests and ministers to the production of people who can work in government.
One of Leyland's St. Paul's contemporaries became Lord Chancellor and died Earl of Southampton. Thomas Wriothesley, the kind of state servant that Henry liked, turned his hand to everything: diplomacy, versifying, torture. Leyland followed humanism's gentler path to preferment. In 1533, he pleased Henry mightily by penning verses in very public praise of Anne Boleyn.
He and Nicholas Udall were employed to write Latin verses and to design pageants for a quite elaborate welcome of the new queen, as she was, into London as part of her coronation. There's a surviving drawing by Holbein for the scene of Parnassus, which is one of the bits that Leyland wrote, which is described in Hall's Chronicle rather wonderfully. For there was the Mount Parnassus with the fountain of Helicon, which was of white marble, and four streams without pipe did rise an ell high, and met together in a little cup above the fountain, which fountain ran abundantly, racked rainish wine till night. But there's another passage where it's both white and red is on stream in the fountains.
And do we have these verses?
We have the verses that Leyland wrote, yes. This is a 19th century English translation of Leyland's Latin verse. Many had told me that Paris saw fairest forms and all beauty, that is, when tending his flocks on Ida's side. He was for giving with impartial hand the golden apple to golden Venus, to the wrath of Minerva and of Jove's sister, until fair Anna joined the company. He's making a nice connection there between Anne and the Greek goddesses of the Trojan myth. There's certainly a coincidence, which surely must be almost a kind of line of causation between doing this work and then getting this commission to go around the libraries.
In Tudor politics, flattery gets you everywhere. It certainly propelled Leyland into his first royally funded set of travels. This early stage of travelling casts him as reference librarian. He lists works for future consultation and seeks texts that might help the king in his great matter of defying Rome and unpicking his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, his first queen. His lifelong devotion to King Arthur, the English monarch who defied and conquered Rome, inevitably drew him to Glastonbury and Wells.
When I was at Glastonbury in Somerset a few years ago, I made a short detour to Wells, hoping I might discover something of remote antiquity.
We're entering Wells Cathedral Library, which is an extraordinarily long space, James Carley.
Yes, one of the longest libraries, I think certainly intact, and I think probably one of the very few libraries that looks almost the way it would have when John Leland was here in 1533.
So the library had been magnificently furnished with no small number of books by the bishops and canons of that city in former times. Thomas Bubwith made the east part of the cloister, with the little chapel beneath and the great library over it, having 25 windows on each side of it.
It gives you a very good sense of what kind of library would have been used in the period and the kind of intellectual life the Vicar's Quarrel would have had.
James Carley, the world's leading authority on Leyland, or to North Americans, Leland, has spent a scholarly lifetime pondering Leyland's travels, writings, and motivations.
He's here partly because he's an antiquary. He wants to find early books. He wants to find books by British authors because he's writing basically a proto-dictionary of national biography. But that's not what his, as it were, his masters, his employers wanted him to do. He was sent here precisely because his patrons, Thomas Cromwell and the Duke of Norfolk, were concerned about the huge fallout there was going to be from this marriage, which was going to lead to Henry's excommunication. They were putting together the documents that would come out in 1534, the Act of Supremacy, making Henry VIII the supreme head of the church under God in England. And John Leland's job was to find texts that would help in this mission.
The books that weren't marked, we don't have anymore. And so what's going on is a very deliberate process of selection, and Leland was clearly playing an important role in that.
The literary historian Jennifer Summit has traced the journeys of some of the texts that Leland marked up and spirited away from monasteries to Henry's newly formed Royal Library.
So that when we go into the British Library, we're seeing the fruits of labors that began with Leland, which is selecting books from the monasteries, bringing them into the royal collection, and then centralizing them into one national collection.
And anybody who walks into the British Library sees that awe-inspiring glass column with those beautiful ancient books at the center of the library.
That's right, and which is a striking image of books as a centerpiece of a kind of national identity. And we could say that that's what started with Leland.
Officially, Leland was searching for books that might please his political masters, but he also dallied with texts that might disturb hardline evangelical reformers, the Tudor heirs of John Wycliffe.
This library, from his point of view as a theologian, was a very interesting library because there were very many books written by people who were anti-Wycliffeite. And if you look at Leland's list of books, most of them are books about the Eucharist. And he is concerned about the Eucharist because Leland is a conservative, unlike his master Thomas Cromwell, and Leland is very concerned about the real presence and terrified of what he sees as a new Wycliffeite threat.
So Leland is a traditional Catholic who believes in the real presence, the actual physical presence of God in the Eucharist.
Yes, and he believed that till the end of his life. A great deal of what has been written about Leland talks about him as a Protestant. He wrote an anti-papal text in 1539, which he had to do. He wrote that when, again, England really hadn't been excommunicated. But you can be anti-Pope while still being a good Catholic. I believe that Leland always believed that England would eventually return to Catholicism. And up to 1536, there is no absolute surety that the monasteries are going to fall. When he's coming around to these places, he has no idea that this is the end.
It seems that when the end did come, Leland had trouble accepting it. His late Latin poem called Swan Song, Signia Cantio, describes ruined monasteries along the Thames as if they were still up and running. In the early days of his visits to religious houses, when he arrived to make his exhaustive inventories, Leland, armed with his royal warrant, was often warmly received by monks who were fellow bibliophiles. Glastonbury, the richest monastery in England, seemed fit to endure for 1,000 years.
A few years ago, I was at Glastonbury in Somerset, where the most ancient and at the same time most famous abbey in our whole island is located. By the favour of Richard Whiting, abbot of that place, I had intended to refresh my spirits, wearied by the long effort of my studies, when a burning desire to read and learn inflamed me afresh. This desire, moreover, came upon me more quickly than I thought it would, so I immediately went to the library, which is not open to all, in order to examine most diligently all the relics of most sacred antiquity, of which there is so great a number that it is not easily paralleled anywhere else in Britain. Scarcely had I crossed the threshold when the mere sight of the ancient book struck my mind with an awe or stupor of some kind. Then, having saluted the genius loci, I spent some days searching through all the bookcases with the greatest curiosity.
This is maybe our very last view of a person looking at a monastic library. This is 1533. It's 6 years before the monastery is completely destroyed. He stayed with the abbot, who he describes in the first version of that text as, he said, a real gentleman and my greatest friend. And this would have been a rest stop. He would have been well fed, his horse well watered, but obviously the library is so exciting to him that that's where he went.
Glastonbury is clearly the telos of this first journey, isn't it? It's the place of destination for him.
In a sense, Glastonbury was the key position because he had come during the period when we were leading to the Act of Supremacy, where ancient histories are cited, and as he says right there, this is the place where you would find the material.
And we're looking out from Richard Whiting's abbot's house through the ruined entranceway of his dwelling, and in the distance we can see Glastonbury Tor.
It is particularly poignant, this doorway where he looks up to his great church on the Tor, St. Michael's, is where, 6 years later, he would found himself hanged, surrounded by two junior monks on either side of him, a trinity on the top of a hill. It is especially sad because this was a very old man, a gentleman by all accounts, and a good man. He did not deserve the fate that came to him. It was very hard to find anything irregular about the life at Glastonbury. When they wanted finally to arrest him, and it was determined that this monastery would go, all they could find was, as they said, a counterfeit Life of Becket in print and some papal bulls. That's all they could find. It was almost impossible to catch this man.
But he would have died looking down on the abbey as he knew it.
He would have died looking down on the abbey as he knew it.
Leland later scratched from his notebook heartfelt references to Abbot Whiting as a truly splendid man and an especial friend. Such prudent erasures and careful marking up of texts continued throughout Leland's career. At that time, choices of texts and phrases could prove, as Richard Whiting discovered, matters of life and death. Leland was careful to delete the prefix Sanctus from his own catalogue references to Thomas Becket. As time went by, Leland must have seemed like an angel of death or harbinger of ruin when arriving at monastery gates. Leland catalogued marvellous holdings which were then dispersed, the monasteries dissolved. The great abbey of Bury St. Edmunds, when first encountered early in his travels, boasted the finest library in the land, some 2,000 books, a vast collection at that time. Berry dazzled like a new Jerusalem.
The sun does not shine on a more beautifully situated town, on a monastery more famed for its endowments, size, and splendour. There are so many gates, some of brass, so many towers, and a church unsurpassed by any other, that it makes you think you were looking on a city.
Just a few years later, less benign commissioners of the king found their way to Bury. Their search for riches was literal, not literary. They left Bury as a series of extraordinary ruins that seem more like the product of some natural disaster.
What's for certain is that he would have wept were he to see what we see before us now.
James Simpson, Professor of Medieval Literature at Harvard.
We see columns of stone beaten as if by the sea, but only after looking at them for a little while do we understand and see that they are in fact humanly crafted columns. They're clearly the fillers for what had been the main pillars of a great abbey church. The destruction of Bury happened with remarkable rapidity. We have letters by people commissioned to destroy the abbeys sent to Cromwell, who administered the Court of Augmentations. One letter sent in 1538 says that, "Have been at St. Edmund's Bury, where we found a rich shrine, very cumbrous to deface. Having taken in the monastery over 5,000 marks in gold and silver, besides a rich cross with emeralds and stones of great value. Today, we depart towards Ely."
The destruction is a complicated business, isn't it? It takes a lot of effort and organisation.
Destroying buildings of this size was no easy business. But one thing we can be sure of is that the fate of books was of little consequence when so much material goods were to be gained in this massive transfer of land and property, the largest such transfer of land in England since the Norman conquest. The Protestant bibliographer John Bale lamented in 1549 about the terrible destruction and loss of monastic library holdings. Bale was no friend to monasteries, but he was certainly a great friend to their books. And he complains that many of the new owners of the monasteries, that's to say people in the Tudor ascendancy, reserved of those library books some to serve their jakes, that's to say their toilets, some to scour their candlesticks, and some to rub their boots. Some they sold to the gracers and the soap sellers, and some they sent over the sea to the bookbinders, not in small number, to the wondering of the foreign nations.
So medieval manuscripts just become a source of spare leather, if you like.
Spare leather, some to scour their candlesticks and some to rub their boots. I imagine that medieval manuscripts may have been used to wrap fish in.
Such events must have anguished Leyland. The gentle bookworm becomes harbinger of vandals, iconoclasts, and destroyers of texts. But spoliation was always latent in Leyland's commission. The king and Thomas Cromwell wanted to know what the monasteries had and what could be had from them. Leyland's book listing was clearly not entirely innocent, and as early as 1534, before the full force of dissolution destructiveness was unleashed, we find him precociously involved in an act of iconoclasm. This is reported in a letter to Thomas Cromwell.
"As Master Leyland and I did walk in the Cathedral Church of York, he perceived a table hanging upon the wall within the said church, and there found represented the reign of divers kings of this realm, among which he found one line of a king that took the kingdom of the Pope by tribute to hold of the Church of Rome, which I cut out of the said table and raised the same, and herein I send you the title thereof as it was in the said table. Your servant, George Lawson."
This table no longer hangs in York Minster, but may still be found in a dark corner of the Minster Library. So, well, that's like a diptych, isn't it, with parchment in the middle?
It is, actually. It is, that's right. It's like opening up a sort of piece of history in front of your eyes.
I gazed upon this astonishing relic of fractious times, with its iconoclastic slash in the parchment, in the company of historian Bill Shields.
And look, you can see it here, that gap on the third column of this kind of four-column parchment account backed onto that wooden frame, which must have been quite a staggering piece of, as it were, iconoclasm in front of the Minster clergy at this febrile time in British politics for an outsider, a royal man from Berwick, plus a royal official, if you like, from London coming up and taking apart one of their treasured documents. They took that piece out because classically, in the controversy over papal power, the reign of King John was one of those central sort of features, as was, I suppose, Becket as well. But the papacy had placed England under an interdict during John's reign, and John had to show obedience to the Pope to remove that papal interdict. So it was a classic case of English royal power accepting that it emanated from papal imperial authority. So that's why it was so important at this time.
And you can really read the future from that great slash, can't you? You know, today the document, tomorrow the monasteries. So this does align Leyland the book lover with more aggressive commissioners.
I think it does, actually. They are executors of royal policy, as well as, in Leyland's case, a disinterested scholarly searcher out.
Resistance to Henry's commissioners was especially strong in Yorkshire, where a full-scale rising was led by a local lawyer, Robert Ask. This pilgrimage of grace saw some 20,000 rebels march on York in October 1536. Thousands of them processed singing down the aisle at York Minster, carrying banners of Christ crucified and wearing pilgrim badges.
Christ crucified, Christ crucified, for thy wounds wide as heaven's guide, which pilgrims be.
Leyland's bookish travels suddenly seem more difficult to distinguish from the more intrusive and rapacious visitations of the king's commissioners, whose top-to-bottom scrutiny of northern monasteries was becoming ever more intrusive.
This creates tremendous uncertainty, and not only were people therefore fearful of the monasteries, but rumour spreads in these circumstances, and many people thought they weren't just going to go after the monasteries, but that was going to be the first step on the way to parish churches and all those local aspects of cultural identity which really gave meaning to people's lives within their own communities.
So Leyland, with his royal patent, would not have been particularly welcome in these parts.
I think that's true. I think people were suspicious of anyone coming from central government with any kind of authority, uncertain quite what it was that they were really up to.
So Ask invents the idea of the Pilgrimage of Grace. What kind of iconography and songs and things did they use to support it?
There are large numbers of monastic houses in this part of the world. The monks themselves participate quite actively. And the monks of Sawley recognise the significance of giving cultural expression and identity to this movement, and so the ballad emerges. They write this ballad reinforcing that message of how regional culture and universal Christian values can be wedded together in a movement like this.
Grim, grim and rich, with Brienne and the Lich, as some men teach, God them amend. And that us may without delay here make us stay and well to end.
Henry VIII, ever willing to negotiate, invited rebel leader Robert Ask to come to court for Christmas, 1536. 6 months later, he was hanging in chains from York Castle. Leyland would have seen Ask's head stuck on a pole in Micklegate Bar as he progressed through York with the triumphant Henry. Travelling around monastic libraries was now far from being a sedate and reflective vocation. James Carley.
My own theory is that the Pilgrimage of Grace, when it became quite clear that monasteries were falling and that if you were associated with them, you could be in serious trouble, he backed right away from them. In 1534, he did a trip round Yorkshire. Many of the abbots he met, whose libraries he discussed and saw, were executed 3 years later as traitors. He talks about the library at Jervo, this wonderful library, and how the abbot in 1534 gave him free rein to the library. 1537, this guy is hanging. You know, he is dead. Leyland moves away, and he travels and travels, and he says, all other occupations remitted, I have traveled through the length and breadth of your kingdom for the last 6 years. And that's what he does.
I have traveled in your dominions both by the sea coasts and the middle parts, sparing neither labor nor cost, so that there is neither cape nor bay, haven, creek or pier, river or confluence of rivers, breaches, washes, lakes, meres, heaths, forests, woods, cities, burgs, castles, principal manor places, monasteries and colleges, but I have seen them, and noted in so doing a whole world of things very memorable.
With so many friendly abbots hanged, this later turn from the visiting of monasteries to the describing of landscapes was a relief to Leyland. He was now determined to catalogue the countryside as thoroughly as he had once inventoried monastic libraries, travelling all over the country in a series of itineraries that survive as multi-volume notebooks. One place, dedicated to an ancient English hero, gave him particular pastoral pleasure in troubled times.
There is a right goodly chapel of St. Mary Magdalene upon Avon River, scant a mile above Warwick. This place of some is called Gibcliff, of some Guy's Cliff. And old fame remaineth with the people there that Guy, Earl of Warwick, in King Athelstan's days, had a great devotion to this place. Men show a cave there, in a rock on Avon Bank, where they say that he used to sleep.
Guy's Cliff, just outside Warwick, is still an extraordinary place.
Okay, right. If you follow me, going down through the undercroft of the chapel, we'll make our way towards Guy's Cave.
It's now in the exclusive care of friendly Freemasons, who are not averse to guiding non-initiates around.
Right, you stay close to me.
I was joined in the dank hermit's cave in the sandstone rock by the Professor of Medieval and Renaissance Literature at Cambridge, Helen Cooper.
Making our way down to Guy's Cave.
It's quite clear that by the mid-15th century or so, a lot of people were visiting here, possibly even as a kind of pilgrimage.
So if you wanted the Guy of Warwick experience, you could simply come into the cave for a few minutes like we are now?
Presumably, yes. And indeed, by the time of John Rouse, who was one of the chantry priests here in the late 15th century, then he's complaining, in effect, that so many people are coming that he can't get his own work done. And he suggests that it would be a very nice idea, if it pleased some good lord or lady, to find in the same place two poor men that could help a priest to sing, one of them to be there continually present, wearing his pilgrim habit and to show folk the place. In fact, he's got the idea that it might be a kind of theme park style place with its own imitation Guy of Warwick dressed up to answer questions from eager tourists or pilgrims or however they thought of themselves.
Guy of Warwick is not a household name today, but how famous was he in the Middle Ages and
Renaissance? Very, very famous, right until into the early 20th century. He's still well known locally, and there are plenty of pubs around Warwickshire called the Dun Cow and so on. The Dun Cow being one of the exploits that seems to have survived purely in oral legend. And it was a very, very large cow which he fought along with a dragon and so on, and was supposed to have been as scary as fighting the dragon. For a long time, one of its ribs was preserved as a relic of Guy, though in fact it was actually a rib from a whale. But that gives you an idea of the size of cow he was supposed to have fought.
Earl Richard, bearing a great devotion to the place, made there a goodly new chapel dedicated to St. Mary Magdalene, and founded two chantry priests there to serve God. He set up there an image of Earl Guy, great, like a giant, and enclosed the silver wells in the meadow with pure white smooth stone like marble.
Beside Guy's Cave is a beautiful 15th century chantry chapel carved out of the same rock face. In what is now a Masonic temple, chantry priests once sang for the souls of the Earls of Warwick. The great image of Guy that Leyland refers to, once a centrepiece attraction for medieval tourists, still stands here today, battered but unbowed.
It's remarkable, isn't it? It's a statue about 9 feet, 3 metres high, that seems to be carved out of the rock itself, even though much of the wall around it is masonry. And it shows this huge figure in armour, carrying a shield on his left arm. But it's very badly battered and defaced. The right arm is missing altogether. There's just a socket. One wonders indeed if the arm and the sword, if they were indeed removable, as the sockets suggest, weren't nicked by souvenir-hungry tourists.
On his way here, he stops off at the parish church of St Mary in Warwick to pay honour to, he says, Johannes Raus, Capellanus Cantuarii Gibcliffe. And he says, this Raus was well learned in those days in maths and was a great historiographer. And of course, it's historiography that Leland himself is practising.
Yes, John Raus was clearly one of his heroes. He was an interesting man and wrote a number of historical or pseudo-historical works, including A History of the Earls of Warwick, that incorporate some of the very legendary ones, not only Guy himself, but also Aeneas or Elias, who was supposed to be one of seven children and the other six were turned into swans at an early age. But Leland himself was a passionate defender of the historicity of Arthur in the teeth of the new generation of humanist historians led by Polydore Vergil. There was fairly general agreement that the stories of the Knights of the Round Table were fables, but there was a historical Arthur too who'd supposedly had massive conquests on the continent and even indeed reached the gates of Rome. Polydore Vergil denied the truth of even those quasi-historical legends, and Leland didn't like that a bit.
Thence over the ferry and to Titchfield, a 2 good miles by like ground.
Later on in his topographical travels, Leland visits his old schoolfellow, Thomas Risley, one of Henry's new men, who's done very nicely from the dissolution.
I left a pretty lake on the left, a little ere I entered into Titchfield town. Mr. Risley hath builded a right stately house, embattled, and having a goodly gate, and a conduit castled in the middle of the court of it, in the same place where the late monastery of Premonstratensians stood, called Titchfield.
So here we are at that goodly gate, the remnant of a vast Tudor gatehouse, which seems almost to have crashed into the nave of a church from the south side.
You can see from the design how deliberately Risley has placed this gatehouse.
Jennifer Summit.
He was putting it into the very nave of the church, and it has both practical significance in that he's chosen the grandest part of the church to build on, but also huge symbolic significance as well, because he's showing how this is a religious structure that he's taken over now as a symbol of secular authority. The gatehouse is the first thing that you see coming in. It's magnificent on the skyline, and it's telling you that this is where a very important person is living.
So he's destroying a 300-year-old medieval monastic building to create a piece of Renaissance medievalism.
I don't know if destroying is the right word, because he's very careful about what he keeps. And also, I think that what he's kept is telling us that he is very aware of what this space would have been used for. So that he's kept the cloister. He hasn't destroyed it at all. He's just remade it. Or the word that Leland uses is translated. That he's taken an original building and then he's translated it to another use.
And how did Mr. Risley come to inherit such a site as this?
Well, Risley is somebody who worked his way up. He had a position of political influence under Cromwell, and I think one of the ways that he proved his trustworthiness to first Cromwell and then to the king was in his willingness to be an enforcer and to do some of the darker deeds of the Reformation.
What kind of dark deeds did he do?
Well, we know that he's somebody who worked his way up through torture, and so that under Cromwell he would have tortured Catholics, and later when he was Chancellor he tortured Anne Askew himself, and she identifies him as having tortured her with his own hands.
Anne Askew was a young woman from Lincolnshire who was tortured for being too Protestant in her beliefs. Risley tortured across theological divides.
What sort of regime did the Premonstratensians lead here?
Well, we know from their library that they were given over to significant reading, that they had 224 books in their library, which is extraordinary for a house of this size.
And they would have walked over these rather beautiful medieval tiles, which are happily preserved at Titchfield. Mm-hmm. A number of them make up a Latin inscription. I don't know if you can actually work it out.
We have a Latin inscription that was actually in the refectory, just as they were coming into the refectory, which was reserved for their eating. And it tells them, before you sit down to meet at your table, first remember the poor. Now, what we also know is that what's extraordinary about these tiles is that they're so well preserved. And they're so well preserved because Risley built over them when he was turning this into his great hall. And for him, it was also used for eating, but it was not for sitting down and remembering the poor. Clearly, for him, it was about displaying his wealth.
For some of Leyland's humanist contemporaries, such as Risley, the translation from religious to secular purposes runs smoothly. But for Leyland, to judge from his travel notes and itineraries, the recent past is rather less easily erased. At many points, he seems to be orientating himself by buildings that are no longer there.
The Grey Friar's house was the best builded and largest of all places of the friars, and stood a little beyond the chief market. The Blackfriars was in the street where the horse market is kept once a week. The Whitefriars' house stood a little above Greyfriars. The Augustine Friars' house stood by the west side of the street by the south gate, hard against St. John's Hospital.
Leyland's travel notebooks vividly record the great depths of historical trauma and change underlying our topography. Jennifer Summit has studied the way that later mapmakers, who are greatly indebted to Leyland, gradually removed this turbulent past from their cartography.
Some of the mapmakers who followed immediately after Leyland tried to incorporate that sense of history in their mapmaking. So somebody like John Norden, who was actually a source for John Speed's maps, included keys to describe places sometimes monastical. Not only would he indicate ruins of places, but also houses that were formerly monastic houses that were transformed into secular houses. But when Speed used those maps, then he took away the same key. And so Speed's maps have no sense of this medieval underlayer.
So Speed's a later stage in a kind of erasure of this
past. That's right,
past.
Yes, I think that's right. So, for example, when Speed gives us Titchfield itself, he gives us an image of Titchfield House, but no indication that there was ever an abbey there before the house. And another example is Whitby, where he gives us an image of Whitby, but no image at all of the ruins, or no indication that there was ever an abbey there. And of course, if you go to Whitby now, the landscape and the skyscape is completely dominated by these massive ruins of Whitby Abbey. But for Speed, they're cleansed of the picture of the landscape.
Invaluable as Leyland's travel notes are to our sense of a disappearing past, they merely hint at the vastness of his ambitions. After all that travelling and cataloguing and mapping a nation in flux, it was time to deliver, to present his ageing king with a handsome return for years of grant money.
There he was. He'd been paid by Henry VIII for 13 years, and what had he produced? A few Latin poems, nothing else. The research assessment exercise wasn't going to look kindly on John Leyland. So there he is in 1546, and he says, "Look, Henry, I've got some great material for you, and I've got it all almost ready. It's on the word processor."
"Whereby I trust right shortly so to describe your most noble realm and to publish the majesty and excellent acts of your progenitors."
He's got the De Viris Illustribus, this great collection of British writers, and that will be four books. He's going to make a topographical tablet, a kind of map, for Henry to be able to admire his kingdom and all his property, his newly gained property, at a single glance. He's going to write a book on the topography of England. And as if that weren't enough, he's going to write a civil history.
So that I esteem that this volume will include 50 books, whereof each one severally shall contain the beginnings, increases, and memorable acts of the chief towns and castles of the province allotted to it.
So what Leyland promises Henry is enormous. How do we know he's going to be able to do this?
We only find out about this extraordinarily ambitious scholarly programme from the text that Leyland gave to King Henry in 1546, now republished in 1549 by John Bale, the Protestant bibliographer. And Bale intersperses his own voice with Leyland's. And as he intersperses his own voice, we find out, to our deep shock and dismay, that Leyland will not publish any of these books because Leyland, though still alive, is now insane. And Bale writes about his bibliographical colleague, describing him as distracted and unlikely to recover.
Quite a few years ago, there was a psychiatrist who was interested in the history of psychiatry and said he would see me to discuss this. So he asked me questions about him. And he said, now, was this a man who gathered material and could never produce from it? And I said, well, yes, that's a pretty accurate description. He said, yes, I call that the magpie complex. And then he looked at me and then sighed. He said, the universities are full of them, you know. So my own theory is he went crazy the same way as I'm going to go crazy. He promised more and more and more books. He produced fewer and fewer. People were beginning to wonder, was anything ever going to come out?
I must say, I prefer the account given by the 17th century antiquarian Anthony Wood, who said Leyland was undertaking so immense a task that the very thoughts of completing it did, as 'tis said, distract him. At the time of the dissolution of the monasteries, he saw with very great pity what havoc was made of ancient monuments of learning. And it's no surprise that Leyland went mad, partly through the violence, but partly through the sheer magnitude of the new scholarly task that confronted him. Not only does he try and gather all those books together, but he tries through his itineraries to gather the whole country together in one capacious scholarly project.
Within weeks of Henry's death in January 1547, Leyland was reported to be in a frenzied state, beyond hope of recovery. An Inquisitio de Lunatico Inquirendo finds him demented by February. He subsequently reported mad, insane, lunatic, enjoying drowsy or lucid intervals. Why does Leyland's near-total mental collapse follow so soon after the death of his king? His tireless travelling rides the fault lines of a momentous time. England is divided along lines of religion, of regional loyalty, and of language. This enterprise straddles extreme contradictions. The kinds of kingly warrant that win Leyland access to ancient English learning become death warrants for monasteries and their abbots. All such contradictions seem for Leyland resolved by the presence of the kingly person. The image and idea of Henry represents something very like a sustaining psychic structure. When Henry dies, that structure, in Leyland's mind, falls with him.
This is the brief declaration of my laborious journey, taken by motion of your highness. So much studying at all hours, the fruitful preferment of good letters and ancient virtues. Johannes Leylandius Antiquarius, scripsit.